Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, offering a variety of steak, pork, chicken, and more for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
The historian Matthew Bowman has a new essay in Slate magazine that caught our attention recently. It's about Steven Spielberg's lifelong obsession with UFOs. And Bowman tells this story about Spielberg as a young boy going out into the Arizona desert with his father to look up at the night sky. It's an experience that apparently stayed with him. In some ways, it became part of the stories he would tell for the rest of his career. Spielberg's new film is called Disclosure Day, and it's his latest take on this obsession with the idea that we might not be alone. In fact, Bowman says Spielberg's very first feature was a UFO movie. It's called Firelight. It came out in 1964. And Bowman says it tells us a lot about where Spielberg started and how far his thinking and our thinking has evolved since then.
There's actually very little of this film left. You can find clips of it on the internet, but only 2, 3, 4 minutes. But we do have descriptions of the plot. And the movie depicts aliens invading a small town in Arizona. And it's a very kind of conventional 1950s style alien invasion movie. The aliens are from another planet. They've flown here because they sensed our nuclear weapons and they're worried that we are going to destroy ourselves. And so they start abducting people as a way to try to avert that kind of self-destruction of the human species.
Maybe it's Firelight, get down.
Tony, what's it going to do?
He gets dozens of people, he gets into hospitals and offices, and you know, shooting on location. And you can really see, I think, him as a film visionary. But you also see, I think, in this movie, a very Cold War understanding of what flying saucers were.
Tony, take me home! Get it away!
Debbie, it's attracted to noise. Be quiet.
Tony, I'm scared!
There are many, many movies from the time that offer a really, really similar depiction of aliens as fundamentally not so different from perhaps another military power on Earth. They behave like a human species. They build technology. They're worried about geopolitics, right? All the kinds of things that Americans worried that the Soviet Union was doing. So in many ways, right, the film is both, I think, incredibly impressive and innovative because he was only 16 years old when he made this massive endeavor and it shows real talent as a filmmaker, but it's also very conventional.
This was his early conception, you know, aliens worried about communism and nuclear war. But you were noticing his ideas have become more nuanced, more complicated, transformed, because the movie Disclosure Day is very different, obviously, in big themes from the thing that he made when he was 16.
Yes. That, I think, is what really fascinated me about Disclosure Day and about other UFO movies that he has made. You see, in the evolution of these films, and we're talking here E.T.
Elliot.
I'm keeping him.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Well, I guess you've noticed something that's a little strange with Dad.
These movies reflect the evolution of how UFO believers in the United States have thought about what these things are. And so we see, I think, Spielberg is someone who's really tapped into the conversations that are happening in the UFO community. He believes that UFOs are real, but he also, I think, shows an awareness of how those things have been interpreted in the past 50 years or so, which is to say less and less and less that they are technology flown here from another planet, less and less and less this idea that aliens are simply another kind of space power who are interested in Earth, and more and more and more thinking that UFOs are a signal that reality is not what we think it is. That these things are, perhaps, more representative of the questions that religion has historically asked then they are representative of the questions that engineers and scientists have asked. And that is what fascinates Spielberg about them. And I think he understands these psychological questions, these emotional questions, these spiritual questions are of profound importance to us. They're why I think UFOs are such a kind of fascinating topic in the United States and something that, you know, strong minorities of American citizens say they believe in. Spielberg does too, and he sees, I think, in our wrestle with them, questions of relationships and identity that really, I think, plague all of us, that we all are very familiar with. And he finds UFOs a useful metaphor for talking about what it is to try to build relationships with other people.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Matthew Bowman is with us today. His essay in Slate is arguing that if you watch Spielberg's UFO movies, you can watch the whole culture change. So his earlier films were about encounters with something out there. His latest film is really about what happens in here. They're stories about empathy and communication and the search for meaning. Bowman believes UFOs aren't really a scientific question. They're a religious one.
UFOs are really interesting because some of the main fights Americans have had about them are over how exactly we should ask what they are. That is to say, are they a scientific problem? Should scientists try to solve them or debunk them? Or are they a religious problem? Right? Are they in fact manifestations of the same kind of human propensity for seeing strange things in the sky that go all the way back as far into human history as we can tell, even to the Bible? Or are they a psychological problem? Are they a manifestation of our anxieties or psychological ailments that we don't really understand yet, right? In a lot of ways, these are the kinds of questions that scholars ask about what it means to be human, right? And how we invent categories like religion or science, right? Ways of trying to understand and make sense of the universe. Those narratives, those stories we tell each other about science, about religion, are ways of making the world comprehensible. And I think UFOs are really fascinating because they are, and the very first word, of course, in UFO is unidentified. Yeah. They are not comprehensible. They are a problem. We see something strange in the sky, we try to figure out what it is. I am interested in the tools we reach for to try to answer that question and how increasingly, I think, as the 20th century goes on, the tools we reach for to explain these weird things in the sky are religious tools. Words like vision, consciousness, salvation, right? These are terms we use to describe these things. And I'm fascinated as over the course of the 20th century, what we might call traditional denominational religion in the United States begins to decline. These other forms that we might call religious, like UFOs, begin to rise. That tells me something really, really interesting. And thus, Steven Spielberg is a figure of great interest to me because I think he tells these stories in incredibly compelling ways. And that he is so obsessed with UFOs, while simultaneously being a person who directed three or four of the top grossing movies of all time, that's incredibly fascinating to me. And it's why I wrote this piece.
I want to remind listeners of a book you wrote. You joined us a few years ago to talk about it, The Abduction of Betty and Barney Hill. And in that book, you know, you argue that, as you were just saying, UFO beliefs often perform these functions that religion used to. And could you just remind people of the central story in that book and what interested you about it? What the questions were there? We spent some time talking about it, but I think it might make some sense to say something about it. It's the story itself, how they themselves believed it or came to tell the stories about it, how those close to them believed it or didn't or talked about that, the evolution of the idea of what they thought they saw, what they in fact did see, and how you translated that. Like, do you treat this as something that happened or clearly couldn't have? It's crazy. Like, just talk about the themes there, because I think a lot of that is contained in the piece that you wrote for Slate.
Yeah. Betty and Barney Hill were an interracial couple living in New Hampshire in 1961. When they were driving home late one night, they saw a strange light in the sky. They heard odd beeping sounds. And they stopped a couple of times on their drive home and looked up at this strange thing in the sky, became alarmed, and went home. Over the next couple of years, they begin having nightmares. Betty had nightmares. Barney began to develop an ulcer and feel a lot of anxiety. So they went to a psychiatrist who hypnotized them. And under hypnosis, they both recalled that that light in the sky had landed on the road, that small creatures had disembarked, taken them on board, and performed medical experiments on them before releasing them. And this is, I should say, the first American account of what comes to be called UFO abduction, which becomes a very, very popular and prominent narrative in American popular culture in the late 20th century. And much of what interested me about that story is, as I said a moment ago, the differing ways that Betty and Barney Hill tried to solve what happened to them. They called the military and asked whether or not this might be some sort of military craft. They eventually, as I say, right, they go to a psychiatrist who tries to treat it as a psychological issue. But then eventually, by the 1970s, after Barney's untimely death, Betty Hill falls in with what is commonly called the New Age movement. And she comes to understand this experience as representative of this kind of broader world of strange, anomalous human phenomena. She engages in past life regression and comes to believe that she had multiple previous lives. She becomes persuaded that Bigfoot is real and that Bigfoots have some sort of psychic connection to UFOs. She comes to kind of perceive this event as being an indication that the universe, in a real kind of spiritual way, is not what she had thought it was one point. Right. And I think we see in that journey, in a lot of ways, the American journey of the mid to late 20th century, right? How Americans, as the denominational religion begins to kind of dwindle in the late 20th century, Americans begin looking to other sources of meaning. And some of those sources of meaning are psychological and the kind of psychology and therapy industry that becomes so powerful and the Hills turn to. And then some of them are what we might call the New Age, or this kind of modern forms of spiritual exploration and spiritual seeking. And for Betty and Barney Hill, right, UFOs are kind of a vehicle into many of these paths. And I think for Steven Spielberg, UFOs are a vehicle into exploring some of those strategies of meaning making too.
Yeah, it's interesting the way his films and the way the ideas in them about UFOs basically or alien life evolved to match what was going on in American culture. I guess that's not unusual. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what was going on in Steven Spielberg's early life, because one of the arguments you make in the Slate piece is that, of course, would make sense for Spielberg to be this UFO nerd because he was born just as flying saucers were becoming a part of popular culture. Spielberg's born in 1946. The first stories about flying saucers, you say, came around just the year after, in 1947. Tell us about this moment in American history.
What is, I think, really interesting about this is not that, you know, suddenly after World War II, people begin seeing strange things in the sky. People have always seen strange things in the sky. What happens in 1947 is that the media seizes on this phrase, flying saucer. And this comes from an initial sighting by a man named Kenneth Arnold in Washington State, who was an amateur pilot. And after a short flight he took, he landed and he told a reporter that he had seen strange metallic disks moving through the sky at rapid speeds. The reporter uses the term flying saucer to describe these. And very, very quickly, other reporters begin using that term as well. And more people start using it. And suddenly then this new category is invented of flying saucer. And then it is associated very quickly with technology. The assumption being, right, we're right at the end of World War II and in the beginning of the Cold War, a period in which jet planes had just been invented. Intercontinental ballistic missiles are being developed. Things in the sky were technology and they were frightening. And that is what you see, I think, in a lot of these 1940s and 50s science fiction movies, They're very concerned with nuclear weapons and nuclear war. There's all these movies about intergalactic battles and combat and so on and so forth, right? That is how flying saucers are thought of in the 50s. Then in the 60s, though, things begin to change somewhat. The ways these things are interpreted begins to change somewhat, and Spielberg's movies follow. And I think that change in the 60s and 70s also mirrors the decline of Cold War fears and the emergence of other ways of thinking about society emergent in the 1960s and 1970s, including the New Age movement and conspiracy theory. And Spielberg's movies then start to follow that. The ways he interprets flying saucers begin to follow that as well.
You're kind of like sort of like a detective in the piece in some ways, tracing Spielberg's interest in all of this. You mention, for example, he memorized the plot of this film from 1956, Forbidden Planet. Like, he memorized the plot. Mm. Like, he knew it down pat. He also has this camping trip that he didn't go to. He had a choice to go to this camp trip with his Boy Scout troop, decides not to go, and they see something and he's just crushed by it. What do you understand about his interest in UFOs? It seems quite, I guess a lot of people were, but his interest seemed kind of acute. It seemed really intense.
Really deeply rooted, right? And I think that story about the Boy Scouts is really, really telling, because the key aspect of that story, and the thing that he will return to in interviews over and over there, is that he didn't see it. Yeah. And he will say in interviews, I have never seen a UFO. And I think that fact, right, that the fact that he has missed out, that sense of longing, of obsession coupled with the absence of the thing itself, speaks to a lot of what these things mean to him. Mm. That is to say that they carry all this kind of connotations of desiring a relationship but never really having it, right? The sense that these things might represent a real connection somehow, a connection to other intelligence, to another being that cares about you, that has your best interests at heart, but that you cannot quite consummate that relationship, right? That's what you see in E.T. It's what you see in Close Encounters. And it's also what you see in how UFO people start interpreting what UFO means in the 1960s and 1970s. There's a real shift toward the psychological and the spiritual, and a real shift away from the military mode of interpreting these things. And that's very evident in Spielberg's work.
Matthew Bowman, he's an associate professor of religion and history at Claremont Graduate University. We're talking about his new essay for Slate. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, offering a variety of steak, pork, chicken, and more for grilling, roasting, and meal prepping. Harmon's, your food, our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian Matthew Bowman. He has a piece in Slate that explores Steven Spielberg's lifelong fascination with UFOs. You probably know Spielberg's new film is about UFOs, but he, of course, has done this before. And Bowman is interested in how these films trace this shift of how Americans think about aliens, from men in flying saucers to something more, I don't know, interesting, certainly more complex, stories that are more about belief and mystery. Basically, it's this: stories about aliens say more about us than them. Okay, let's talk a bit, and we'll come back to it as we sort of work through this. But let's talk a little bit about the new film, Disclosure Day, his new film.
Good morning, Kansas City. Let's take a look at today. Today is...
Give us a sense of what it's about and where the idea comes from. Because Spielberg, as you mentioned in your piece, has been thinking about this for a good while now.
Yes. That word disclosure in the title is really key. The word refers to a movement that's really been, I think, around in the UFO world for nearly 50 years by this point. It is a reference to the idea that this community believes that the U.S. government has a great deal of knowledge about what these things are. And indeed, perhaps even technology from these things. And perhaps even, as some believers will say, biologics. Mm-hmm. But the government is keeping this secret. And the reason why the government is keeping a secret is a point of argument in the film, right? The reasons are offered that, you know, American society is just not ready for this. It will destabilize humanity. It will turn the world into chaos. So we have to keep it secret. In 2017, the New York Times published a really groundbreaking story that revealed that, in fact, in the very recent past, in the last 20 years, the federal government has had offices investigating this phenomena, offices gathering videos, gathering evidence, gathering stories, and trying to suss out what these things are. Spielberg, like many other people, read that story and was really blown away. And that's when Spielberg started to think about this and to think about the meaning of this kind of, again, this longed-for revelation, this longed-for consummation that's just being held just out of reach. And there is such a large population of disclosure advocates who are continually frustrated that the government is not revealing all that it could, and that perhaps in 2 weeks or 6 months or a year, there's going to be another congressional hearing, there's going to be a new whistleblower, and the truth will be revealed, and we will, as a human species, then come into contact with this other intelligence, and our entire society will be transformed. That's the kind of hunger and longing, I think, that's at the heart of this new movie, the desire for this sort of revelation and the consummation of this sort of relationship, and the powers that are trying to keep it from us. That's the essential conflict. But in many ways, it's the same story Spielberg's been telling for, boy, more than 60 years now.
So the tension in the film isn't about – I mean, his first one may have been. But as he matures in thinking about these ideas, it's not about the aliens, you know, coming aboard and harvesting our organs and subjugating us. The conflict, as you say, is not between us and them. It's within and among us. This is a theme he's interested in.
More and more, yeah. I think. And you see that even in some of his early UFO movies, right? There's a really profound relationship between a human and an extraterrestrial and ET,
right,
of course.
Right.
But there's also in that movie, the real tension comes from conflict between humans. And in Disclosure Day, not to offer a spoiler here, but in Disclosure Day, aliens are almost entirely absent. Almost all the conflict is between humans. I say in the piece, I think in some ways, Disclosure Day is Spielberg finally being blunt about all of the themes, all of the ideas that he's wanted to explore here. They're laid out for us in a very literal way in this movie, and that sense that the real conflict is between humans, and it has always been between humans, is one example of that.
So originally, when Spielberg is first making movies about this or thinking about this when he's a kid, the idea was that aliens were just more advanced than we were. You know, they had familiar things. They flew spaceships. They had guys in space outfits. They were just better at it. They had just more advanced technology. So the assumption was if people were seeing UFOs, they were seeing spacecraft from another planet. But then you mentioned, you were sort of talking about this earlier, by the 60s, most of the UFO believers or investigators stopped thinking that. It transformed. It became another kind of belief. What's the transformation? Go through that for us.
There's a couple of people who are really key here, people who write books in the late 60s that really change how a lot of UFO believers think about this. John Keel is one, Jacques Vallée is another, and Alan Hynek is the third. And the idea you see emerging in these folks, and indeed in how they themselves have been evaluating this thing, Hynek and Vallée had for a long time been well, Hynek, I should say, had been a contract worker with the government when the government did have research projects into these craft. This was Project Blue Book, before that Project Sign and Grudge, and Hynek would receive footage or photographs from the government, and he was a trained astronomer with a PhD, and he would offer his opinion on them. He's thinking largely in the early years in these technological terms, that these things are just nuts and bolts. If they are real, they're spacecraft from another planet. And Jacques Vallée writes a couple of early books that make that argument too. But then in the late 60s, Vallée writes a book called Passport to Majonia. Majonia is a medieval kind of spiritual world. And Vallée argues in this book that perhaps we're thinking about this all wrong. Perhaps UFOs are not simply spaceships. Perhaps they are the same kind of thing that we used to, in earlier millennia and centuries, perceive as angels or fairies or ghosts, that we need to understand them as being what we might call spiritual phenomena, not physical phenomena, really. And Alan Hynek, who is a friend of Vallée, increasingly is influenced by this idea. And he begins to write about this phenomenon that he calls high strangeness. Yeah. And this is from his 1972 book, The UFO Experience. And he points out in this book that if these things are simply spaceships like our spaceships, why is it then so many people who report contact with them have these bizarre phenomena happen to them? Things like missing time, where suddenly they seem to lose an hour or two out of their day, or the sense of telepathy, that they're communing psychically with the beings on these craft, or this strange sense of levitation, right? And these craft can somehow manipulate physical materials, right? And he
it's almost spiritual. It's almost spiritual.
Yeah. Precisely, right? Yeah. He's moving toward what Vallée is arguing, that we shouldn't think of these things just simply as advanced technology, but perhaps a different category of thing entirely. And eventually, Vallée becomes to believe that these things are interdimensional or multidimensional, and they exist on planes of existence that we don't really perceive all the time. And Hynek, I think by the end of his life, has come to that conclusion as well. This dovetails then with another phenomenon that's happening in American culture in the 60s and 70s, which, as I've said earlier, is the New Age movement, right? This sense that human beings themselves exist on multiple spiritual planes, that the purpose of our lives is to learn how to channel our kind of spiritual experiences and become in touch with intelligences beyond our own, right? And in many ways, then, the UFO movement and the New Age movement start to intermingle. And that is much to the frustration of a few UFO believers who remain entirely convinced these things are simply technology from another planet.
Yeah.
But I think by the 21st century, the Vallée-Hynek view has become really the dominant way of thinking in UFO conventions and in UFO groups.
How do you explain it? Is it that the sort of American consciousness and popular culture became more nuanced and sophisticated? Or is it, as you said, the ideas of religion, for example, in particular, just weren't working for Americans in the same way? They were looking to kind of transplant, you know, some of that thinking to some newer form? Is that how you're understanding it?
Yeah, I think there's something to that, right? I am really influenced, I think, as a scholar of these things by Carl Jung, the famous psychologist who wrote a book about, well, what he called flying saucers in the late 1950s. And his argument was the flying saucer is not an object in the sky. Rather, the flying saucer is a story we tell about objects in the sky whose identity is not readily apparent to us. So that might mean this thing in the sky is a spaceship from Alpha Centauri. It might mean the thing in the sky is a cloud or a bird. It's whatever it is, it's something you do not readily interpret. And so what do? We apply narratives to these things. And that invention of the term flying saucer, right, was a way in which our culture began to apply meaning to things we did not understand in the sky. And I think that's what we continually do. people see something odd in the sky that they cannot readily identify it, so they call it something else. And I think we see over the second half of the 20th century into the 21st century, the stories that we tell about these things in the sky come to reflect to us the things that our culture is obsessed with, is bothered by, is worried about, right? And the meanings we ascribe then to the things we cannot identify tell us in a real sense who we are. From 1950, when we were worried about atomic bombs from the Soviet Union, to the 1990s, when we're worried about government and conspiracy, and then we get the X-Files, which uses UFOs to tell us how we are so terrified of institutions, right? This is why I think UFOs are so powerful. They are changeable. They can become what we need them to be.
So let's get back to Spielberg and how his films are sort of tracking with all of this. After Firelight, when he's 16, several years later, of course, comes Close Encounters of a Third Kind. This was in 1977. Set this film up for us. You say Close Encounters is positively drenched in high strangeness.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, this is a few years after Hynek and Vallée have written their books, after these reports of UFOs performing weird feats have been widely spread in the UFO community. And so we have in this movie, right, we do have these craft that seem to be technology from another planet.
Yeah.
But we also have these craft that are capable of bizarre things. They appear to be able to kind of wink in and out of existence. And they can create these psychic bonds with human beings. They can affect us emotionally and mentally and psychologically. And that's what we see in the movie, right? Over and over and over, these people who in some cases are dissatisfied with the world around them, who are overcome with the problems of communication with other people, they turn to these craft and they find this bond that transcends for them any relationship they have with a human. That bond is not always uncomplicated, I think, as some of the characters reveal, but it is something that they find incredibly powerful. Powerful enough that in some cases, right, they abandon other people to seek it out.
One of the things you mention, you've written about this in your book, you sort of refer to this in your piece for Slate, the effect of these UFO encounters on people, or, you know, what people believe the UFO encounters and what effect that's had on their lives. Let's talk about the character of Roy Neary in Close Encounters. He's a character played by Richard Dreyfuss. People will, of course, remember he's the one who builds the Devil's Tower out of his mashed potatoes at dinner. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, out of dirt and rock in the house, terrifying his family.
What are you doing?
I got it.
What are you doing?
I figured it out. That's all. Will you just listen?
No.
Ronnie, look. You ever look at something when it's crazy and then you look at it in another way and it's not crazy at all?
No, I haven't, no.
Come on, Ronnie.
And you mentioned in the piece how he develops his own, you were referring to a psychic bond, he develops his own psychic bond with those lights that he sees. He has that encounter and it affects him mentally and physically and emotionally. Talk a little bit about his experience. What's going on with this Roy Neary character?
Yeah, he's such a powerful character for Spielberg because I think in some ways, right, he is this quintessential Spielberg protagonist, which is to say he's a human being who feels somewhat dissatisfied with his life, who is groping for someone, some being to really understand him and come into contact with him and save him in this sense, right? And this is, boy, I think we see characters like this in so many other Spielberg movies. But ultimately, right, he finds this real communion with these strange lights in the sky. They affect him in profound and powerful ways, and he hungers for more of this relationship. But Spielberg also, I think, sees in Neary the damage that that can do as well. Right. When we see Neary doing these sculptures, right, when he's building Devil's Towers out of mashed potatoes, this is happening in this fascinating context of a just tumultuous home.
Right.
You've got Neary and his wife and his children, and they're just kind of bouncing off the walls and yelling at each other. And he is sitting there in the center, kind of sculpting this tower, seemingly oblivious to what is going on around him. And then, of course, at the end of the movie, he chooses to board the spacecraft.
Right.
And to just simply abandon his children
yeah.
and his family. In one way, right, the movie presents this as this incredible culmination. You've got this wonderful John Williams score that is just soaring, and you see this incredible special effects of the inside of the spaceship, right? It's a really powerful moment. But then at the same time, right, we've seen so many scenes of Roy Neary being a bad father. So there's a real, I think, ambivalence here that Spielberg is putting his finger on. He really, I think, senses how profound UFOs can be for people. This sense of untrammeled, perfect communion, one soul to another soul. But at the same time, right, Spielberg is also aware that these relationships are always dangerous. They're always fragile. They can always do damage as well. And he, as a child of divorce, certainly understands that. And you see both of these things, I think, manifest in Roy Neary. And it's just, it's remarkable to me that Spielberg, who is, you know, 30 years old when he made this movie, can develop that kind of complexity.
There's another theme that you've identified in Spielberg's work. I guess it's about communication, or a lack of communication. How our efforts to communicate and understand each other can be sometimes just complete failure, or they can be this miraculous breakthrough. We see both of those in his films. Say something about that.
Yeah, and you also see that again in Close Encounters, right? That Roy Neary seems incapable of communicating with his family, but he can be in this kind of wonderful communion with these alien beings at the same time. It's not a mistake, I think, that Close Encounters begins with a character who's incidentally based on Jacques Vallée, the French writer I mentioned earlier, trying to find a translator so he can talk to people who speak Spanish. Then it ends with this character stage managing this incredible kind of musical communication with an extraterrestrial craft. A lot of Steven Spielberg's movies kind of focus on these questions of translation and communication and trying to be understood by other people, and sometimes having that fail, sometimes having it, I think, wonderfully, wonderfully successful. And gloriously successful. I'm thinking also, right, of E.T., the extraterrestrial, which is maybe Spielberg's, I think, most emotional movie. Yeah. In that movie, right, you have these children who are children of divorce, right, who find this extraterrestrial creature, and they bond with him, and they're able to, I think, communicate with him in this wonderful way that children do. There's this incredible scene, and the first thing, this little boy, Elliot, when he meets this alien, the first thing he does is show the alien his toys. Which is exactly what children do, right? When they see other children, that is how children communicate. That is how they build relationships. But then, at the same time, nearly all the adults in E.T. might as well be alien beings because they're always doing things that these children find strange and terrifying and incomprehensible, right? They don't understand why their parents divorced. They don't really understand what their mother is going through. And it takes this alien, I think, to illustrate for the children what this sort of profound, unconditional love of a relationship can do and can be.
Another theme that you've sort of identified is that the gift that humans seem to be getting from aliens is what you describe as radical empathy. And this is something that comes through in Disclosure Day. One of the characters you mentioned explains that these feats that aliens are capable of are, as you put it in the piece, rooted in radical empathy. And you also say this in the piece, that it's maybe the first time Spielberg has been so blunt about it. What do you mean?
Yeah, that he uses that term, right? I mean, we see the term illustrated, right, in E.T., in all these other movies. But yeah, in Disclosure Day, one character does tell the other, right? The aliens are capable of these incredible things, and they can give humans gifts, gifts of insight, gifts of, at one point, actually, a character turns an entire room invisible. And one of these characters who has worked with aliens for a long time says, all of this comes from their capacity for radical empathy, for understanding other beings beings at such a deep level that they can, in fact, kind of shape how humans perceive the world around them. That is, I think, Spielberg simply writing the text out for us. And perhaps at, the end of the 60-year movie-making career, Spielberg has finally kind of come to the point where he says, this is what I have been saying all along. This is where real power comes from.
Matthew Bowman, we'll put a link to his essay in Slate on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking with the historian Matthew Bowman today, talking about an interesting article he's written for Slate. And here's the theory. If you watch Steven Spielberg's UFO movies, you can see how Americans' ideas about aliens have changed over the years. So in the early days, it was nuts and bolts science fiction, spacemen in flying saucers. But over time, UFO stories moved in a different direction to what believers call high strangeness. It's where the mystery is less about visitors from another planet and more about consciousness and spiritual experience. Bowman says Spielberg has been following that evolution for decades, and his new film, Disclosure Day, may be his clearest expression of it yet. I think it's fair to say that I guess you seem less interested in whether the aliens are real, because you sort of explore this in the book. You know, did that actually happen? What are you guys talking about? That's crazy. You're less interested in that, and you're more interested in what the experience of encountering them or people thinking they've encountered them does to people and says about people. Is that fair to say?
There's kind of two questions here, right? The first is, are UFOs actually manifestations from another civilization?
Sure.
And in some ways, right, that's the question that is somewhat irrelevant to me. And it's irrelevant for two reasons. The first is that we have had decades and decades and decades of people claiming that they are this thing, and decades of days of other people saying, no, they're not. And here is evidence. Here is how I kind of can explain what it is you really saw. Here is why faster than light travel is impossible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But despite all the efforts of those debunkers, people keep saying, I saw a UFO. I met an alien. And the question I am interested in is, why is that? Why do people keep claiming that this thing happened to them? Why is this story so powerful and so compelling? That is the second question that really does interest me. Why is it that this story, among all the possible stories for explaining strange things in the sky, has become so powerful that it has such a grip on our culture that someone like Steven Spielberg has made half a dozen movies about it?
You mentioned this book that was published by the Harvard psychologist John Mack. And Mack publishes a book about the effect of these UFO encounters on people. And he took those claims seriously. In the same way you do with your book, you take those claims seriously. You don't just dismiss them. And that makes it controversial, because Mack believed these people who believed they had these encounters had encountered something real. Whether it was quote-unquote real, he believed them in that sense. But the other thing was that he also believed that and mentioned that they had developed a deeper sense of the world. Like, the thing that had transformed them is they had been imbued with, and not in all cases, but in some cases, with a kind of empathy and sensitivity and a sense that the universe was good, or potentially could be a good thing. And that's also really interesting. Explain that.
Yeah, this was controversial at the time. So Mack, as you say, he taught at Harvard Medical School. He was a psychologist. He had won a Pulitzer Prize for some of his previous work. And then he grew interested in people who said they'd been abducted by aliens. And he began working with many, many of them. And he wrote this book about their cases. And he argues in this book that, as you say, many of these people describe experiences that were sometimes very frightening, in which they saw a bright light, they were taken into the light, they experienced some of these effects of high strangeness, like levitation and psychic contact and so on and so forth. But then when they came out of this experience, they were often had gained some sort of strange sense of peace. And what Max sometimes called a kind of mature and eternal perspective. They begin to see the world as a beautiful place. They begin to have greater interest in massive problems like war and the environment. And Mack argued that for many of these people, this phenomenon actually was positive. Now, there were other UFO folks who didn't like this at all. Some of the most prominent UFO investigators of Mack's time believed that the creatures on these strange craft were actually hostile and wanted to do humanity ill. And they thought that Mack had been kind of taken in, that he was naive and gullible. And then, of course, on the other side, Mack was investigated by the faculty of Harvard for spending time on such what was judged to be such a kind of frivolous course of academic work, right? So Mack was really taking it from both sides in a while. But I think Mack's perspective really does illustrate, I think, Spielberg's as well. Mack was a deeply kind of optimistic person, and so is Steven Spielberg. They both have this kind of sense that humans are capable of really profound things, and that there may be these sorts of experiences that can unlock that in us, that can open up who we are in ways that might point us toward, as Spielberg might put it, more radical empathy.
I want to ask about, you say there's always this paradox in Spielberg's UFO films. On one hand, there's this deep bond that develops, but that bond comes at a cost. You were referring to this earlier. Elliot's bond with E.T., for example, as you say in the piece, it threatens both of them. They learn that they can't stay together if they're going to flourish, that there's this paradox there. How do you make sense of that? That's interesting.
Yeah, you see that also, I think, in what we spoke about earlier with Roy Neary in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right? The sense that the kinds of relationships that human characters are offered in these films by these aliens are incredibly powerful and meaningful, and someone like Roy Neary will sacrifice almost everything to get it. And in many ways, right, these relationships heal Elliot in E.T. They are transformative. They do, as John Mack argued, they do elevate these human beings to greater senses of who they are. They bring them better perspectives. They're profoundly healing, but at the same time, they're also dangerous, and they can be dangerous. And I think that is one thing that saves Spielberg from what he is sometimes accused of, which is sentimentality. Of kind of presenting a world in which everything ultimately works out, where people hug and cry and, you know, and reconcile. But there is also, as we see within both E.T. and Close Encounters and in Disclosure Day as well, there is a kind of dark underside that Spielberg's aware of too, that there is a danger to these sorts of things.
You mentioned a story I hadn't heard before about Spielberg, how right around the time of, you mentioned Carl Jung and he wrote this book. Right around the time of that book, Spielberg's father took him into the Arizona desert to see a meteor shower. And he was, as you say, alternately terrified and fascinated by it. What did you learn from that story?
Yeah, this trip was frightening to young Spielberg. He was only, you know, 11 or 12 at the time. And his father woke him up late at night and said, "We have to go." And he bundled him out, right? And he's this young boy who's been woken up late at night and being taken out into the desert by his father in this car. And that is a little bit frightening. Yeah. But then at the end of this, when they reach this kind of empty desert and they look up and see this kind of tremendous meteor shower, Spielberg just finds this kind of profoundly moving and sort of astonishing. Like, he was not aware the universe could do something like this, right? And it became, I think, a really profound illustration for him of what wonder is, of the kind of awe that human beings are capable of, and also a real bonding experience with his father. who is someone who you really, I think, mentored Spielberg through his youthful artistic endeavors, who gave him that video camera that he made Firelight with when he was a teenager. Right? It was a real kind of profound experience for that relationship as well. And then, of course, a few years later, his parents divorce, which is, you know, kind of the flip side of this kind of tremendously devastating experience for the young man. And all of that, I think, wrapped together illustrates the paradox of UFOs for Spielberg. They are ultimately tremendous gifts, illustrations of how powerful and transformative and beautiful and gorgeous the universe can be. But also at the same time, right, they are signs of the unknown, of what might be frightening or sometimes even dangerous about the universe and about other people as well.
And you say they raise the question, can we be brave enough to be kind to one another?
That is, I think, the question at the heart of all of Spielberg's work. And you see it, I think, in all of his movies. I mean, really profoundly in a movie like Bridge of Spies or Schindler's List. Opening yourself to someone else, having radical empathy for somebody else, being willing to enter into a really close relationship with someone else, it is always a little bit frightening because it always means that you are opening yourself and you might be vulnerable. Spielberg thinks that's worth it, even despite the fact that it can sometimes hurt you.
Matthew Bowman, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
Matthew Bowman, he's an associate professor of religion and history at Claremont Graduate University. We'll put a link to his essay in Slate on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can email us at radiowest@KUER.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.